in Caracas, and then it has audio of Machado speaking. And Garcia Navarro translates, "When you have a democratic country, the people can ask for a change of government," she says, "as stipulated by the Constitution. But when it's a dictatorship like we have here, what we need is organization and public pressure to enact change. That opposition in Venezuela has a long history of divisions, but the difference of opinion is now poisoning the wells further. One activist told me that what is happening behind the opposition scenes is a civil war, and far from helping the protests expand, he said, it may be what does them in." Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, end quote. And Lourdes Garcia Navarro is the go-to reporter for NPR when it's time for a fresh pile of steaming U.S. propaganda about Venezuela. Here's an example of her latest work on the U.S. dollar rate crisis, maintained by none other than predatory practices of U.S. banks, of course. Quote, "The exchange rate is just one example of the economic crisis that has prompted weeks of unrest in Venezuela. Many basic goods have been in short supply, and inflation has been running more than 50% under President Nicolas Maduro, who champions a socialist economy, as did his predecessor, the late Hugo Chavez," end quote. Did you get that, huh? Socialist policies. That's the takeaway. And that's, you know, that's what the American public takes away. That portion of the American public that listens to NPR News and feels that they're getting the long form, balanced journalism that one might expect in a fantasy world. But don't expect to be on the guest list at the next surprise Cheney speech if you didn't get the message. The BBC and the New York Times have been enthusiastically supporting the would-be new coup, which is why when pro-Maduro activists get decapitated by our freedom-fighting pro-U.S. protesters, their deaths get blurred into 30 dead in the protest, giving you the impression that all the deaths are due to the evil machinations of Stalin. I mean, Chavez. I mean, Maduro. I have a statement by a list of Venezuelan supporters of the popularly elected government. You can find it at venezuelanalysis.com. And I present it here as counter-propaganda. It's dated March 25th and is followed by an extensive list of its supporters. This is a collaborative statement. They write, "Two demonstrators at a pro-government march for peace in Mérida recently died. The banner reads, 'No more violence. We want peace and life.'" I was reading the wrong script. I'm sorry. Let me start again. This is the statement by the various Venezuelan human rights experts as they style themselves. They offer their views on the guarantee of human rights in the current protests. They write, "As leftists and human rights activists, we, the signatories, offer a new summary of the events which have occurred in the country in recent days. We reiterate the warning about the persistent distortion of the issue of human rights as shown through the disinformation campaign on the situation in Venezuela that many national and international media outlets maintain. The utilization of human rights discourse continues. During February and March, large media corporations contributed to the notion that the Venezuelan government has responded to legitimate student demands with brutal repression. As a consequence, this notion portrays a systematic and generalized violation of human rights of peaceful protesters. In effect, there are cases that point towards the responsibility of state officials. However, an analysis of the facts indicates that a purposeful distortion of the issue of human rights is being created at this moment. Some non-governmental organizations, NGOs that defend the pro-opposition students, have circulated statistics of high levels of mistreatment of protesters, including torture and arrests. However, the number of cases presented to the Attorney General's office, including those brought to international organizations, was less than those publicly announced by those non-governmental organizations. In recent declarations, the UN's Rapporteur Against Torture, Juan Mendez, said in relation to the cases that have been brought to this organization, quote, "There are two or three cases that I would say qualify as torture, but that doesn't mean there aren't more. Those that have been brought to my knowledge are two or three," end quote. Again, this is the collaborative announcement that I am presenting as counter-propaganda. This is from VenezuelaAnalysis.org. They write, "Many of these denouncements are made through media or social networks, are substantiated by images that don't match the Venezuelan reality. Others have been debunked publicly by witnesses. With respect to the right to life, the number of victims attributed to security forces is significantly less than a lamentable toll of political violence between civilians. Moreover, there is a deliberate omission of the violent character of many of the protests. Together, this has created an international perception of a grave crisis in human rights in Venezuela. After 5 weeks of protests, the official toll is 461 wounded and 1,854 arrested, of which 121 remain in custody. The majority of those arrested were given bail conditions and the rest were freed without charge. 33 people have lost their lives. All of these losses are equally painful for the country, and an analysis of the circumstances that produced this is a warning to us of the dangers of allowing an agenda of political violence that is of a nature previously unknown to Venezuelans. Of the victims, 17 died on street barricades, 15 died in the context of street protests, and one was shot while leaving a student meeting. 27 of the victims were civilians, among them a public attorney and a maintenance worker with the mayoralty of Caracas, and the other six were officers of security bodies. Of the overall toll, 28 died from gunfire as a consequence of the political violence, 4 were violations of the right to life, and 1 was an accident. 3 deaths are attributed to the indiscriminate and disproportionate use of force by security officials in the control of disturbances at the end of marches organized by the opposition. These denouncements include the intelligence service officials and National Guard officer. Another victim died as a result of blows received during a local protest repressed by the GNB. 10 deaths also occurred during protests as a result of gunfire, presumably committed by civilians. 5 victims participated in protests organized by the opposition. 3 were GNB officers shot while controlling violent protests. The other 2 victims included a worker who had returned from a government-organized peace march in Bolivar State and a Chavista student leader that was calling for the demobilization of the violent groups and the restarting of academic activities. A teenager was also run over by a civilian who tried to pass through a street blockade by force. Of the 17 who died on barricades, 7 were motorists or passengers of vehicles that couldn't dodge obstacles placed on the road. 8 suffered shots from firearms. In the other cases, a protester was stabbed during a dispute on a barricade, and another accidentally fell from a building. 3 civilians and 3 GNB officers, that would be the government officers, died as a result of gunfire from a building while trying to clear barricades to open the road. And departing from this text, and just adding to this, when they say unable to clear barricades, that includes motorcyclists who were decapitated by wires that were set up to decapitate motorcyclists. And these would be pro-Chavez, pro-Maduro, pro-government people. Returning to the text of the statement, the protests have been attributed to several motives: shortages of certain foodstuffs, personal insecurity, the high cost of living, and other legitimate reasons for discontent. In the course of events, the protesters themselves and the various opposition leaders recognized that the ultimate aim was to force the exit of the constitutional president without turning to the correct constitutional mechanisms to do so. The information cited contradicts the notion that many of the protests have taken place in recent weeks in Venezuela have been peaceful. We stress that if indeed there have been peaceful marches and demonstrations, there is also evidence of the use of firearms by demonstrators in many of these incidents. In recent declarations, the president has announced the seizure of 25 guns, Molotov cocktails, catapults, large objects, and C4 explosives that were handed into the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General, Luisa Ortega Diaz, reported that 21 of the security officials wounded during the control of the protest received bullet wounds. Again, I have to step back from this and say, when you hear that protesters have C4 explosives, do you still consider them protesters? C4 is a military explosive. When I hear that, I think of the many, many regimes overthrown by the CIA, and certainly that is what is being attempted in Venezuela. You don't get your hands on C4 explosives down at the grocery. You need someone to supply them to them. And the U.S. military has them, and the CIA has them. Excuse me. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm presenting a collaborative statement as counter-propaganda. Counter-propaganda specifically against the New York Times, the BBC, and NPR, which seem to be on the bandwagon for the recent, and I'm glad to say, failing attempts to overthrow the democratically elected government in Venezuela. Returning to the text, above all, we cannot speak of peaceful barricades as they have been verified to be dangerous. The barricades have affected the main and secondary roads in middle and upper income sectors in 8 of the country's 335 municipalities. Let me say that again, 8 of the country's 335 municipalities. So departing from the text again, when you hear that the whole country is exploding, that's just propaganda that you get from NPR. Anyway, returning to the text, all of which are governed by opposition mayors. Cables, barbed wire, felled trees, rocks, and spilt grease oil on asphalt mixed with disused furniture, tires, and rubbish that are lit on fire. All of these things have been used. The covers of public drains have been lifted, leaving holes in which at least two motorcyclists have died. Messages exchanged in social networks and testimonies in mainstream media reveal that those who participate in this type of protest believe they are in a state of war. Since the beginning of the protests in Venezuela, local authorities of these municipalities have not condemned the deaths that have occurred on barricades, and neither have opposition spokespeople or student leaders. The exception is in the case of Valencia, one of the cities with the greatest levels of confrontation. On the 17th of March, the pro-opposition mayor of the city of Valencia, that would be the pro-U.S. mayor, Miguel Cocciola, rejected the violent acts, and without referring to concrete responsibility for the deaths, said, quote, "I don't believe that violence is the way. People must understand that there is no way that the country will progress that isn't through dialogue with the government. The barricades haven't produced results. What they have done is pit neighbors against neighbors. There are places where there isn't cooking gas and ambulances cannot enter. This can't be allowed," end quote. Following that statement, Cocciola was expelled from his political party, the Voluntad Popular. The silence of local authorities, they write, in the municipalities where the barricades are occurring contradicts their mandates and can be interpreted as collusion with unconstitutional violent protest tactics. If indeed their responsibilities in the maintenance of public order are limited, and despite the fact that the barricades are organized through social networks, no mayor has taken provisions such as increasing vigilance in specific affected areas. Very much to the contrary, these opposition municipal authorities have stopped fulfilling their responsibilities to collect rubbish and to maintain public spaces. Debris and trash have been left on the street for days, impeding traffic and further creating an additional public health concern. Such a situation prompted demands for the protection of collective rights by a citizen from one of those areas, which was heard by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ordered the mayors to fulfill their responsibility of regulating vehicle transit in order to guarantee adequate and secure passage through the public roads of their municipality. In the following days, the Supreme Court widened the order to prohibit the barricades in four municipalities of the country. In addition to all this, the barricades caused the loss of classes in various educational centers, negatively impacting children and youth's right to education. The transport of sick people who required medical attention was also affected in some places. These violent forms of protests have acquired particular severity in the border state of Táchira. Before I continue with this collaborative statement, I would like to say that this is all very familiar to those who follow the tactics of the CIA. I'm thinking specifically of CIA tactics against the government of Honduras more recently, and against, the 9/11 attack on Chile. The September 11th, 1973 attack on Chile followed this script very closely. There was a degradation of provision of services, rumor mongering, all sorts of disruption. It was organized by a radio station. I believe the CIA agent in charge of that, I may be forgetting, but I think his name was Townley, but it doesn't matter. It was a CIA agent who was in charge. And the idea is to crank up what has been called the mighty Wurlitzer of press denunciations, domestically and internationally and in the U.S., until some point of instability can be reached. And then, as in Ukraine, the government can be toppled whenever people are disorganized enough not to shoot back. Returning to the text, the Attorney General, I'll go back a little bit. On the other hand, we point with great concern to what appears to be the practicing of fringe forms of violence, such as the use of snipers, armed strikes, sabotage, and selective assassinations, and even the marking of the houses of Chavistas, pro-Chavez people, in an area of the country's interior. I'm sorry, I have to stop reading again and say what that's about. The marking of houses means death squad threats. Mano Blanco, for example, the White Hand in El Salvador, famously marked houses with a handprint. Hand that had been painted in white and slapped on the door, and that meant that the persons who lived in the house had the wrong political opinion for those U.S.-supported death squads and needed to disappear before they would be murdered. And then they would be regularly, if they did not disappear, they would be murdered. And that was very much, that was those were the people that Ronald Reagan called the equivalent of our founding fathers. I'll just leave that, but returning to the text, we warn of the possibility that these forms of violence could turn into ongoing residual forms of resistance to the government and state institutions. The right to peaceful protest is fully protected in Venezuela, as various demonstrations undertaken by the opposition prove, the most recent protest being last Sunday. However, faced with the violent character of the barricades, the state has the duty to use mechanisms to maintain public order and the protection of people with an adherence to the law and full respect for human rights. In recent days, the violent protests have reduced significantly. On 17th of March, the national government undertook a public order operation to restrict the violent protests that have been daily in Plaza Altamira, the center of the strongest protests in Caracas. In coordination with municipal authorities, special security mechanisms were established to ensure peace in the area. Since then, a group of peaceful protesters has remained in the square. The Attorney General has informed the public of the status of the different cases mentioned. Days after her appearance before the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, she said the Attorney General's office is investigating 59 cases of presumed violations of human rights, and 17 officials of different security bodies are being held in custody as a consequence of the violent acts which have occurred in recent days. Here again, speaking for myself, compare that to what happens when the U.S. enforces its unofficial Jim Crow code. Are people brought before the court? Are the police brought before the courts? Is the UN Human Rights Council consulted? Returning to the collaborative statement. With respect to this, we indicate two aspects that get in the way of the administration of justice. Many of the denouncements, especially those related with personal freedom and physical integrity, are made through media and social networks without offering proof to the competent state bodies. In other cases, the testimonies of the victims contradict with the results of the following technical investigation. And by the way, when they say media and social networks, you must understand that most of the media in Venezuela is owned by pro-U.S. propaganda organs. According to information from the Attorney General, they write, the officers responsible for the deaths of two people are under arrest and are being judicially processed. The same is happening with the GNB officer involved in the case of Jose Alejandro Marquez and the mistreatment suffered by the artisan Marvinia Jimenez in the city of Valencia. In the cases of the deaths, which occurred in the framework of the street barricades or were caused by armed civilians, investigations are underway, and in some cases, suspects have been arrested. It's worth mentioning that on the 6th and 7th of March, the Attorney General met with two of the non-governmental organizations that had denounced torture and mistreatment. These were the Penal Forum and Provea. One of them didn't officially report a single case, and the other handed over documentation on 40 cases, several of which were already being investigated by the Attorney General's office. Likewise, meetings had been held with NGOs and the Ombudswoman. They write, we are not facing a systematic policy of human rights violation. We insist, they write, that the violations of human rights, including the cases of violation of right to life and denouncements of mistreatment and torture, should be condemned and must be fully investigated. According to official information, all the cases of killings attributable to security officers are being processed by the competent judicial authority. The Attorney General has stated that if an officer, no matter the rank, commits a crime of torture, cruel, or inhumane treatment, we are going to punish them. Likewise, she has assured that the Attorney General's office isn't going to permit any arbitrary arrest. Meanwhile, President Maduro has also recognized that there exist security officers that have broken their rule of defending the human rights of the population and has shown his will for these situations to be investigated and punished. Here again, I invite you, compare with police abuse in the United States. Again, to the statement of the group, beyond official declarations, both an analysis of the protests in recent weeks and the evidence of the measures adopted by different state powers to tackle the violent protests and confront the cases of abuses by security forces indicate clear political willpower and contradict the notion of a systematic and generalized policy of human rights violations. You getting that, NPR? Between these measures, it is worth mentioning the effective use of mechanisms for the administration of justice, the dialogue with human rights NGOs, and the application of legislative and executive measures to preserve the human rights of the population in the maintenance of public order. The principles of the progressive and proportionate use of force must be those that guide the actions of the GNB, official police, just as the Constitution establishes. Situations such as the current one in Venezuela reveal the need for the government to insist upon and deepen the efforts that it has been undertaking to profoundly reform the state security forces and adjust their conduct to the full respect of human rights. If indeed important achievements have been reached in this sense, it is imperative the government assures continuity and due urgency in the application of this fundamental agenda. The capacity of the Venezuelan society to resolve its differences and overcome the crisis of the moment has been demonstrated, just as was recognized by the resolutions of the Organization of American States, or OAS, and the Union of South American Nations, the UNASUR. In this context, we consider that the invocation to foreign intervention that is found in the discourse of a sector of the opposition and that has been enunciated by some international actors, NPR, is unacceptable and doesn't contribute to ending the conflict within the parameters of the Constitution. On the other hand, mutual recognition between the political forces of the government and the opposition is a necessary prerequisite of a dialogue-based solution to the conflict. Violent protests and media manipulation don't create solutions to the legitimate problems cited by the opposition leadership. What is required to confront these problems is the development and application of agreed-upon policies through the institutional channels offered by the Constitution. The resorting to violent tactics as a strategy to force a resignation of a legitimately elected Venezuelan government, the demand that characterizes the rallies and slogans of the protesters, means putting yourself outside the Constitution and international law, which in no moment validates violence, as a legitimate way of achieving political objectives. Moreover, the refusal of the leaders of the opposition and the protesters to participate in dialogue and the lack of condemnation by opposition leaders of these forms of protest add to these problems. Once again, you're listening to KBOO Portland, coming to the end of the broadcast, and I've been sharing part of the statement of the human rights experts from Venezuela, in other words, the pro-government left. And I've been presenting this as a partial counterbalance to the constant drumbeat of the BBC, the New York Times, and National Public Radio in their contribution to the imperial attack on Venezuela. There is more to that statement, and they make several demands. They say, in our role of human rights activists and facing the situation described, we express ourselves in the following terms. We repudiate the persistence of practices that constitute violations of human rights. Skipping ahead, we show solidarity with the victims and their families. We exhort national authorities to push forward measures that strengthen the process of police reform. And there are several other demands. Find that at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You've been listening to Press Watch. Do stay tuned to more of the incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland, your free radio station. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I'll be back next week. And all the ships at sea.
Listening with the Seamstress of Sound airs on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10 to midnight. From hip-hop to folk rhythms, the Seamstress spins a soulful melody sure to keep you active. Check out Active Listening on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10 to midnight on KBOO.
Our relationship seemingly falling apart at the seams, but our grandmothers were both seamstresses for a reason.
Good morning, and welcome to A Deeper Look. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, sitting in for Linda Olsen-Osterlund, and my guest is award-winning journalist Julia Angwin. Her new book is Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. It's now on the bestseller list, I understand. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Okay, thank you for being here. And let me also add that you have been a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, where you led a privacy investigation team that was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize in explanatory reporting, and won, that's in 2011, and you won a Gerald Loeb Award in 2010. Dragnet Nation looks at how the government, private companies, and criminals use technology to indiscriminately sweep up vast amounts of our personal data. What's the significance of the term dragnet in your title?
Well, you know, the thing is, it used to be really hard for the government to do dragnets or companies. I mean, the classic dragnet was the police setting up roadblocks and inspecting people as they drove by. Now, with technology, you know, the ability to set up a dragnet is in the hands of almost everybody. Our technology is so cheap and powerful. Police are driving around with these automatic license plate readers that snap pictures of everyone's cars as they drive by. And as we've learned from Snowden, the NSA is sweeping up everything it can get. And so are companies.
So dragnet, you know, I hadn't ever realized that it actually means like just a, like sort of dragging in the ocean for a fish.
Right. Yes, right. They've banned it, I think, for some fish.
Yeah, right. And you say that the corporate and government dragnets are inextricably linked, that neither can exist without the other. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, a very good example of this is voting records. So in order to vote, you usually have to give some information to your state election board, such as your name, address, sometimes your birth date, sometimes political affiliation. And then what most people don't realize is many states sell those lists to commercial data brokers who add that data to, for instance, your magazine subscriptions, your property records. And they build up these files that are pretty robust, and then actually sometimes they sell them back to the government, or they sell them to other companies that use them for other purposes. So they both rely on each other. The government buys this data from the commercial entities, and the commercial entities buy it from the government.
And you also, in the book, compare the level of contemporary U.S. citizen surveillance to the level for someone who lived under the notorious Stasi regime, the East German secret police during the communist era. Why do you do that?
Well, you know, the truth is that I wanted to check whether I was being kind of too paranoid. So I thought, you know, who were the most repressive secret police out there? And are we looking at anything that's even remotely comparable, or am I just getting too worried about this? So I went to East Germany, and I visited the Stasi archive, where they have all the files from the secret police. And what I was struck by was two things. One is that they only had files on one quarter of the population, and yet everyone felt very scared during that regime. They were afraid to speak publicly. They were afraid of the consequences of expressing dissent. And the other thing was that their technology wasn't anywhere near as robust, right? They had to steam open the mail. They listened to calls, you know, in live and real time. They didn't have computers to analyze all this data. And so it made me think that we're in a situation where our government has files on 100% of us and not a quarter. And so the question I have is, how can we make sure that our government doesn't ever succumb to the temptation to use that information for repression, to stifle political dissent? I don't think we're there, and I just want to make sure we don't get there.
Page 95 of your book is one of the most chilling to me. Page 95 of Dragnet Nation. It's at the end of the chapter on the audit that you did of what you could find about the data that had been collected about you from various sources. And you say that you only obtained a tiny amount of the information about yourself. But if I could read the list to tell people what was included that you found: every address I had lived at dating back to college, every phone number I had ever used, the names of nearly all my relatives as well as in-laws, a list of nearly 3,000 people with whom I exchanged email in the past 7 years, records of about 26,000 web searches I had conducted every month dating back 7 years, neatly sorted into categories such as maps and shopping, a glimpse of my shopping habits, my internal communications with my employer, the Wall Street Journal, about reporting plans. That's a very chilling list.
Yeah,
and that's
I was stunned.
Talk about what that was like to get that information, just what you got right there.
Well, I have to say that was also a small slice of what's out there about me. Mm-hmm. I was actually kind of mostly unsuccessful in getting my information. I mean, that's the shocking part. I identified more than 200 data brokers who sell names and addresses and lists of about people. And of those, only about a dozen would let me see my files. So in fact, what you're talking about reflects a very small slice of the information. I also included in there the information that Google and Facebook would let me see about myself, which I found was too revealing. And in the end, I decided to leave Google as a result because I realized I didn't want to keep using their services when I was contributing to that much data storage about myself. And, you know, in the government realm, I really didn't get that much information about myself. I got one big packet from Customs and Border Patrol about my records of travel. And the FBI said they didn't have anything and couldn't confirm if I was on a watch list. But the files I got from Customs and Border Patrol were really shocking because it turned out my employer, Wall Street Journal, was inadvertently sending internal communications that reporters would send to their bosses about the purpose of travel. We had to fill out a form sort of internally on our web portal that would say why you wanted to travel, and then your boss would approve it. And then those files, as part of the booking of the trip, would actually just be sent to the government. It was unbelievable. Anyways, once I let them know, they worked really hard. It took almost a year for them to change the system so that it wasn't automatically sent to the government. But, I mean, people just don't actually know where the data is going.
And so kind of turn that around as to how that might apply to somebody else, somebody listening to this program and their travel patterns.
Well, I mean, most people just don't, I think, realize how rich that data is about their travel. I was really surprised. I kind of thought it's sort of innocuous, you know, I'm traveling, you know, I'm used to the idea that you have to go through TSA, whatever. But the files that the government gets from your airline actually are really detailed. It talks about which seat you're sitting in and which kind of